Thank you all for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. Please consider supporting the work that I am doing with this podcast by going to the podcast Patreon page. That is patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. You can go to that site. You can become a monthly contributor. You can make very small monthly donations there. You can do as little as, I think, $1 a month. And by doing that, you can gain access to the content of these episodes a week in advance. So I'll have the conversation, the interview, available for you on that site. You can download it as an MP3, and you can listen to it, again, a week in advance before I officially release it with all of this extra stuff that I add to the beginning and end of it. So consider that. For those that are already contributors, that are already patrons, I really thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. I know you don't have to do this, and you do it because you appreciate what I am doing, and I thank you so much for the contribution. If you'd like to find out anything else about this podcast, the social media sites, which is on Facebook, Twitter, the SoundCloud, iTunes page, all of that, you can find that at the podcast website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know about this podcast can be found at that website. Our guest for this episode is Ricardo Manzotti. Ricardo is the author of The Spread Mind, Why Consciousness and the World Are One. Ricardo teaches psychology of perception at IULM University in Milan, Italy, and has specialized in a few different things, artificial intelligence, artificial vision, perception, and, of course, the philosophy of consciousness. The discussion you will hear in this episode deals with a few different subjects brought up in Ricardo's work, namely what the spread mind and its underlying premise is and what it means in regards to our understanding of what the mind as we currently understand it to be really is, and how scientific exploration into the brain and neurological functioning will not ultimately lead to any real answers regarding where our conscious experience comes from. Ricardo's new book, The Spread Mind, delves deeply into this fascinating subject and radically shifts our understanding of the dilemma of consciousness and points to another much needed and necessary way to understand this subject. You can find that book, The Spread Mind, at your local bookstore. You can find it online. I will provide a link to that in the description of this episode. I'll also provide links to Ricardo's website, which is consciousness.it, and also some links to some conversations that he has with the New York Book Review. I think that the work that Ricardo is doing is very important because one of the dilemmas of trying to understand what it means to be a human being and what it means to be alive, of course, is trying to understand where does this all come from? Our awareness of being aware, right? Our understanding of what a thought is. Can it be isolated to the neurological activity inside the brain? Can it be something that can be found within a brain, or a piece of organic material? I mean, is that even possible? Our understanding for hundreds and hundreds of years in the West has been that, yes, you can eventually figure out where the mind resides in the brain. Unfortunately, even after hundreds of years of scientific progress, we have yet to come to any real understanding of where the mind resides as far as within that particular model of understanding consciousness. So Ricardo, I think, among other people, is providing a new way, a much needed perspective on understanding what consciousness is, what our experience of consciousness is, and what the mind ultimately is. As you go into this episode and as you listen, you're going to hear the beginning of this conversation was unfortunately cut off. When I was recording this conversation on Skype, for whatever reason, there was an issue. So the first, I think, 10 minutes of this conversation is gone. And that's just one of those things that you just have to deal with as a podcaster occasionally when you do these long calls from someone that's way on the other side of the world using Skype. Normally, like 90% of the time, I would say it works fine. There's those occasional problems that emerge, though, with these types of things. So what I've done is to give you context as to what's the conversation, because you get into the conversation a little bit later. I'm going to provide a little bit of context. I'm going to play a very short video that is on Ricardo's website that very simply gives you the understanding of what the theory of the spread mind is. He has a very, like a 2-minute video, just explains it in very simple terms, so that when we get into the content of this episode, you'll understand what the hell is going on. Also, I'd just like to touch on a few things. We talk about psychedelics. We talk about hallucinations. We talk about how these fit into his view of consciousness. So there's a lot of subjects that are covered beyond just the basics. So I'd like to thank Ricardo for taking the time to do this. It means a great deal that people are willing to talk to me about these subjects. Again, check out Ricardo's book. It goes into much more depth, into these subjects. So thank you all for listening to this episode.
One of the biggest problems nowadays is the nature of conscious experience. Namely, how is it possible for a living being to have a conscious experience? If we take a brain, if we take a body like this one, it is basically an object. It is just an object with physical properties. How is it possible for this object to have feelings, to feel anything, to have an experience of an object? And nobody today has been able to provide an explanation about how neural activity can transmogrify into conscious experience. But the problem of the orthodox approach to consciousness is that all these neural activities are different from our experience. The properties of the brain are completely different from the properties of my conscious experience of the world. The spread mind theory tries to outline a completely different answer to the problem of the physical nature of conscious experience. Whenever we have a body with a brain perceiving an object like this apple, we have something which is the experience of the apple. Now, there are two possibilities. First possibility, the experience is inside the brain. But this possibility has a problem. Nothing inside the brain has the properties of one's conscious experience. On the other hand, we have the apple. The apple has all the properties of one's experience of the apple. Namely, it is red, round, and apple-ish. A radical theory like the spread mind takes into consideration the possibility that the physical thing which is one's conscious experience of the object, is the object itself. With a slogan, my experience of the apple is the apple I have an experience of. This is the basic idea behind the spread mind.
Let mean, at what point did you come to this way of thinking about the mind and about experience and consciousness, which are kind of the same thing, as you have written? You know, you use those words interchangeably. So if the mind in our conscious experience is not something that can be reduced to neural activity in the brain, then, you know, and as you say, like when you see an apple, you are just experiencing the apple as it is. It isn't this representation in your brain. You're not making it up. It's just there. Your consciousness is a part of the apple and everything else that you experience. So what is that then? I guess that's always when I was reading your work, I guess I didn't get enough of them into the material, and I don't know if you get to this point later on in your work, but what is the mind then? You know, if there is even a way to describe it.
No. That's a very good point. In my view, the mind is just the part of the world we are experiencing at any time. So, for example, right now I am in my room. I see my books, my bookshelves. I see a painting. I see my sofa and a bottle of orange juice. And I would say that in this moment, my mind is one and the same with these objects. No more, no less. With all the properties that these objects make available to my body, which are not all of the properties of these objects, but only a subset of the properties, of the physical properties of these objects in the room. For example, surely there must be neutrinos, there must be infrareds, and many ultrawaves and many other physical properties I am completely unaware. But there's a subset of physical properties right now, right here, and I would say that my conscious experience is just one and the same with these physical properties. But let me just say one more thing, that my explanation is not different from the explanation that neuroscientists have been looking for so far. At least the form of the explanation is just the same. Let me explain. Neuroscientists have been looking for a version of what they've been calling the mind-body identity theory. In other words, they have been looking for some neural activity that they could claim it was identical with our own conscious experience. So they've been looking for some physical phenomenon taking place inside the brain that they could say had the right properties to be considered our own conscious experience. So they would have been perfectly happy to be able to say that a neural activity in my fusiform gyrus in the cortex, in the temporal cortex, is identical with my experience of Michelangelo's face, so to speak. And that explanation would have been accepted by the scientific community. Now, I am just proposing a completely identical explanation. I am also suggesting a physical phenomenon, and I am saying that physical phenomenon is one and the same with my conscious experience. Only that the physical phenomenon I am suggesting is not inside the brain, but is there. Is there in the world. And it has all the properties of my experience. So that's an important point, that the form of the explanation I am suggesting is just analogous with the explanation that has been so far suggested by neuroscience. Only that I propose to look for a different physical phenomenon, to look elsewhere.
Okay. Absolutely. So I was sort of thinking about this question. So let's say that I'm looking at, say, you use that red apple as a object, as an example. So if I look at this red apple and we're both looking at the same thing, So your experience and my experience, we're both seeing the same object. But let's say that I'm under the influence of like LSD or something, or some psychedelic, or some, maybe I'm mentally unstable or something like that, right? So I'm looking at the apple, but I don't see an apple. I see a little dragon that's, you know, shooting flames out of its mouth and is running around the table. Is that, what would that be? How would that fit into your understanding of how the mind is and works? I mean, obviously people would tell me that, no, you're hallucinating. You're not seeing something that's actually there, because everybody else sees the apple, but you're looking at something and seeing completely different. I mean, what would that, how would that fit into that? And I think also maybe dreams could also be right. Fit into that question as well. Like, so illusions, hallucinations, and dreams, you know, what, how is that a part of your theory and your idea?
Very, very good question. Let me get there in two steps. Mm-hmm. First step, let's assume that we are just perceiving the apple. So let's forget for a moment dreams and the hallucination, but I will get there. But for a moment, let's just consider the fact that when we perceive an apple, we may see two different apples. Maybe you are colorblind. Maybe I don't like apples. Maybe I am short-sighted. There can be plenty of reasons why two people that are just perceiving the world in a standard way, nevertheless, they are going to perceive two different apples, to some respect at least. After all, the differences in subjective perception is one of the main reasons why people have introduced the notion of mental experience, of subjective experience. Because scholars had to explain why I see, say, an apple and you see a different apple. So, The traditional explanation is that we don't see the external apple, but I see my own representation of the apple while you see your own subjective representation of the apple. And in this way, they were able to explain very cheaply how is that we all can see a slightly different representation of the world. But now, let me introduce you a notion that I found very convincing, which is the notion of relative object. Consider this case. Consider for a moment an even simpler case, the notion of relative velocity. Now, if we are moving at different speeds, what about the velocity of the apple? If I ask you, does the apple has the same speed with respect with you and with me, or does the apple have two different speeds? Of course, you would reply to me that the apple has two different relative speeds, has two different relative velocities, because the velocity, which is a relative property, is also a relative property. Velocity is not an absolute property. So if we were moving different velocities with respect to the apple would have two different velocities, two different relative velocities with respect to you and to me. Do you agree? Mm. Okay. Yeah. So it is conceivable that a physical property like velocity is different relative to you, to your body, and relative to my body, because my body has a different relative velocity than yours. So if that's the case, we can just generalize the notion of relative property to all other properties. So for example, consider color. My eyes are surely different from your eyes. They have a different number of photoreceptors. They have a different number of cells. They have a different sensibility to light. And therefore, colors may be another relative property. So it is conceivable that as the apple has two relative velocities relative to two different bodies, so the apple has two different colors relative to two different physical systems.
my eyes and your eyes, because physically my body is different from yours. So we can generalize the notion of relative properties, and we can understand that the world doesn't exist in an absolute way, but rather the world has a relative existence. So this would pave the way to conceive the world in a way that it is like velocity, namely made of relative and multiple properties. So we don't need any longer to have a subjective mental representation of the apple to explain the fact that my experience is different from your own experience. Because if we accept the notion that the world is made of relative properties, relative to our bodies, then the world can be different relative to your body and relative to my body. So that would explain why we experience two different apples. Because we experience two different relative apples, which are different, but they exist in the external world as different apples.
Okay.
And
yeah.
No. And that's the case in which we don't hallucinate, we don't dream. So in that case, we are just entering in the same room. We are looking at an apple which is actually there, and we are having two slightly different experiences. But rather than explaining what's going on in terms of subjective experiences of the apple, we can explain that in terms of different relative apples that are actually there. There are multiple apples, in a way, on the table, because there are multiple bodies relative to which those apples may exist. And, I mean, this is just for normal experience. Then you can consider what it takes place when we hallucinate or dreams. And this is another classic objection to views like my own that suggest that what we perceive is actually there. And in this case, my reply is based on empirical evidence. The first empirical evidence I want to point out is the fact that, as far as we know, hallucination and dreams are extremely constrained by one's actual life. So what I try to say is that hallucination and dreams are chimeric. How would you say in English? Please help me here.
Like a chimera.
A chimeric. Why do I use the word chimeric? Because the chimera was created by putting together pieces of different animals. Mm-hmm. So it was not an arbitrary, complete new creation, but rather it was a composition of different existing animals. Mm-hmm. So what it is interesting here is that the same happens in our own hallucinations and dreams. We are unable, for example, to dream a color we have never seen. We are unable to dream or to hallucinate a taste or something whose elementary components have not been experienced in our previous life. If we go through all the literature about, for example, direct brain stimulation, like in the case of Penfield, the famous neuroscientist who first stimulated people's brain and induced hallucination, we will see that there hasn't never been a single case in which people reported a truly new elementary experience. And if you think about that, that's quite surprising, because given a brain that is made of 30 billion neurons with gazillions of connections, and if you think about everything that may go wrong in an extremely complex structure, if our brains were really responsible for creating, for example, colors, sooner or later, brain should make a mistake. They should create a color that people have never met in real life. But that never happens, neither in dreams, nor in hallucination, nor in the more exotic conditions. So why is that the case? Why is that the system so reliable that it never makes makes the mistake of creating a novel elementary experience, like a completely alien color, a completely alien phenomenal experience? A possible explanation is that dreams and hallucination, as I said before, are chimeric. So they're only a reshuffling, a recombination of previous experiences, and I would say of previous physical properties.
Okay, please ask me, I
assume that you have a question that is waiting to be asked.
So something that I talk a great deal on this podcast, I talk about psychedelics, and I find that I've talked to a particular psychiatrist named Ben Sessa, and he's doing the first clinical trials with MDMA in the United Kingdom. It's really fascinating research, because what it seems to be able to do is it allows people, this particular psychedelic compound, to process traumatic experiences that they've had in their life. You know, PTSD, right, as it's called. And he's working to do the first clinical trials regarding the use of that for psychiatric purposes. In my own personal experiences with psychedelics, I think what it is it's interesting what you're saying, because it's what it's saying. What you're saying is that when I have, say, a hallucination or a visionary experience, as it were, with, say, whatever it is, whatever drug it may be, that I am merely experiencing things that I've already experienced to some degree. Maybe you're talking specifically about dreams, but I kind of interpreted what you were saying, that even with, say, a hallucination or a visionary experience, that I am kind of, I'm re-experiencing things that I had previously have experienced, but it's reshuffling it and remolding it in a different light. And I think that that makes sense for therapeutic purposes, but let's say like a person, and I've talked to another person who's an artist who went down to the Amazon forest, and he partook of ayahuasca, and ayahuasca, of course, is a psychedelic compound that has been used for, I don't know, countless years by indigenous people down in that region. And what they often explain is that, you know, when you have this experience, you are being visited by a kind of intelligence outside of yourself, and that it is entering your body, and it is healing you, and it is giving you this really profound experience. And I guess to me, like when you talk about it as if it's a reshuffling of previous experiences, what I often hear, and what I personally have experienced as well, is that it often feels, at least, that what I'm experiencing is a completely new thing, something that I have never thought of before. It's never occurred to me before. And I think many other people have had that experience as well. And I know that maybe your book doesn't get into this question, but it's something that I think a great deal about, which is what psychedelics really are. Because if you're taking, say, a mushroom and you're ingesting it and digesting it, and you're put in this completely different mental state, mental state, and you're definitely able to rethink about things in a completely different manner than you were previously able to do so before that. But sometimes, if this experience is powerful enough, you really do feel like something new is being kind of experienced, something that you never would have thought of before, or never would have occurred to you before. So I guess my question is, what is that? I don't know if you've thought about it, and if you don't have an answer to that question, I totally understand. I just am, when you were describing those things, it just sort of came to my mind, like, you know, what is that experience then, if we're using your hypothesis?
Right.
to sort of describe it.
Yeah. Well, this is a very interesting point. I had to do, I had many interactions with people that had tried ayahuasca and kind of psychedelic drugs, because of course that's a crucial test bed to any theory like my own. So my first concern was whether there was any obvious case of the fact that these drugs were able to produce a completely, for example, new palette of phenomenal experiences, which actually was not really the case. But it is true that in the use of these drugs seems to expand or to allow to experience the world in a different way. Well, actually, this is consistent with what I was saying before. Because I, for example, something that is very common with people taking LSD or MDA is the fact that they claim that they perceive reality, that they perceive visually the world as everything were brighter, or if they were able to distinguish better hues of color or other features or patterns or other features. This is consistent with what I was saying before. Basically, it can be explained by simply by saying that in such states, the brain is open to pick up from reality more properties, more patterns that it usually does. So, it is possible that what the brain perceives during hallucination is actually there. I am referring to many, not to all of it, I will say something more about that, but I'm referring to some very simple changes in the visual quality of the external world. And Let me use a metaphor that has been used many times and most notably by Aldous Huxley. The metaphor of the narrow channel. In everyday life, our brain has to select only a very limited number of properties in the external world. It is like a very narrow channel, trying to funnel only a limited number of physical properties, those that are most useful in order to survive, those that are most useful in order to basically get shelter, reproduce, have success, finding food, and so forth. Of course, this subset of physical properties of the world is only a subset, the most convenient one. But of course, there are plenty of physical properties that we usually don't perceive. A very well-known example is offered by what is called inattentional blindness, like the famous video with the gorilla or other cases, in which people can show that we perceive only a subset of the external world, and that the more we are focused on a task, and the less we perceive of the external world, because we pick up only those features that are relevant for what we are going to do, for our goals. So, it is conceivable that certain brain states, and please take note of the fact that I never use the word mental state, but only brain state, because I believe only in physical things. So, I believe in brains, I don't believe in minds. So, it is perfectly conceivable that certain brain states are open to a larger subset of physical properties than everyday experience, than everyday life. And it is conceivable that psychedelic drugs do exactly that. They allow the brain to be more open to a larger world. To many extent. And I would like to add one more thing. Because of historical reasons, nowadays, we allow science to tell us what the world is really made of. For example, consider the opening title of a journal, of a popular journal like New Scientist. Most of those titles have this structure. What the world is really made of. What we really see. What we really think. What we really want. So, in our society, we gave to science the role of telling us what the world is really made of. And it is never what we perceive. It is never what we experience every day. It is always something else. This is strange. Because it is an historical outcome of the authority that we gave to science and to the scientific community to tell to everybody else what reality is made of. But for example, if I feel a pain, if I see something, if I have a feeling, is not my feeling real? Is not my pain real, no matter what science may say about the causes of that pain? So, the same, I believe, is true when we talk about hallucination, dreams, and perception. We have an historically historically biased notion of only a certified and limited set of physical properties. And those properties are those properties that we consider to be the real properties of the world, and we call them perception. Then we call everything else dreams, hallucination, and so forth, because they don't fit into the accepted view of reality. But they are no less real in a way, because, for example, they are producing effects, they are producing experiences, they are producing reactions. So we react to what we dream. So we react to what we hallucinate. So my point is that everything we have an experience must be physical, because it is producing effects through our body. And it must, therefore, fit into the, natural world. Only it may not be part of that limited subset that we call perception. So what I am trying to say is that perception may just be a subset of the external world, rather than being different, once again, in terms of a mental against a physical world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if, let's say that scientists, neurologists, people who are studying consciousness, studying the mind, were to adopt this new way of thinking, your way of thinking on this particular subject, and they would stop focusing so much on trying to kind of figure out how all of this is coming out of the brain, all of this is just a phenomenon of your, you know, neurons firing in a particular pattern, and it creates the experience that you're currently having. So if they were to, say, adopt the spread mind theory, the spread mind hypothesis, whatever it's called, where would their focus go then? You know, if the mind is something that is not cannot be reduced to those terms, I mean, I guess what would they then be focusing on, you know, instead of that? I mean, where would they be looking for it, I guess, if I were to use that way of saying it? You know, where would it be at? Where would the experience of our existence be at, if there is even a place that it would be? You know, obviously, maybe that's not the right way to even frame the question. I mean, maybe there is no at, there is no place that it is in. It just is, you know.
No, it's also at. I mean, it is at. Because it is located in the external world. If this theory were taken into consideration, neuroscientists should always consider the brain as a piece of a larger physical system, which is made of external objects plus one's body and brain. So it's not really something that it is asking to consider anything which is not physical or which is beyond the physical observation. It is something that is simply larger than the limit of the body. And let me say, I always like a metaphor, which is that of the dam and the lake. So, if you have a dam and a lake, of course, the dam is responsible for the existence of the lake. So, in a way, you can study the dam, and from the property of the dam, how high it is, how large it is, you can derive the properties of the lake. But, of course, the dam is not creating a lake. If you had no rain, you can build a, mile-high dam, and no lake would take place. So you need other conditions. And if you are interested in lakes created by dams, you have to consider both the dam, both the dam and lake, the terrain, the rain, the water, and many other conditions. And of course, the lake would still not be the dam, no matter how important is the dam for the existence of the lake. Mm-hmm. Likewise, what I would suggest in neuroscience is to stop looking for a consciousness in among neurons. According to my view, they will never be able to find anything like that. But they have to consider the brain as the physical condition that brings into existence an external object, which is not mysterious, which is not hidden at all. It is just there. It is the object that exists relative to one's body and brain. So by changing the properties of the brain and the body, perhaps taking drugs or by taking prosthetic devices or by all kind of intervention on the brain and on the body, one will also change the external object, because it is like with the dam. If you change the shape of the dam, if you change, for example, the height of the dam, you're going to change the size of the lake, because you will have more or less water. So you can make prediction about one's subjective experience by using my model, because you take into consideration two physical system, the external object and the brain and the body together. And then you can derive a prediction about what external object is going to be singled out by a given brain and body together. And my point is that, assuming this perspective, will it be possible, for example, not only to make prediction about what we are going to experience and to what we know people are experiencing in different medical condition, in different cases. But we might be able, for example, to make experiment or to make prediction for completely unexpected cases. For example, is it possible to expand our own experience? Is it possible to have a direct experience of infrared or of ultrawave? Mm-hmm. Can we do that? Is there any way in which we can expand our the world we are made of? And the spread mind makes suggestions about the condition that will be necessary in order to do that. How to, for example, allow human beings to experience new phenomena, new physical properties that have never been part of our experience.
Yeah. I'm excited to see. I really hope that your ideas really affect scientific theory and affect the way that people think about these things. Because I think that what I've seen, you know, is that people like neuroscientists and the like, maybe philosophers of the mind, you know, whatever they are, that they focus too much on what we discussed previously, of course, is that experience is something that is manifested out of neural activity in the brain, and that if they were then to focus their energies outward and say, no, that is not where consciousness comes from, then, you know, imagine what, I mean, it's actually kind of a frightening thing, because if we were to give up our reductionist ideas and to expand our scope and to look outward and see, like, okay, so consciousness is not something that is isolated to the brain. So what does that mean? You know, like, I think that's, of course, what human beings are always striving to do, right, is, like, find meaning out of everything. And it was comforting for a while to assume that, oh, well, we have a consciousness that is isolated to our own brain and that we're just perceiving the world through that. But it's another whole, it's a wholly different thing to sort of look at it the way that you're proposing, which is that, no, that is not the case. So if that is the case, you know, what is mind? What is experience? What is consciousness? And I think it's liberating in a lot of ways, because, like you mentioned, they're not really, they're getting to a point where they realize that their model and their way of researching this subject is very limiting. It's not yielding results. It's not getting them what they want, essentially, which is answers. And so I really hope that people heed your advice or listen to your ideas and start to use those more. So Ricardo, we've been talking for about about 45 minutes or so, almost an hour. I would really appreciate if you could direct people towards your work. You know, if social media, your website. Anything like that, in your book as well, of course. And I know that hasn't been published yet, but if you could give some information on that, that would be great.
Well, actually, the book has just been published, and okay. So it is available.
Okay.
As of this very week. So I'm happy okay. to say that everyone who is interested can have a look at the OR Books website and to look for the Spread Mind, which is available. And
wonderful.
That's one thing they can look at, or they can check for my dialogue. I have an ongoing series of dialogue on the New York Review of Books. They can check for my name on that website, and they will find those dialogues together with the novelist, the writer, Tim Parks. And another thing they can do, I invite everyone to do, they can check on on Facebook. I have a page, and I'm happy to answer as far as I can to any comments, to any suggestion. So they can check for Ricardo Manzotti on Facebook, and I'm definitely happy to reply, because I think that this view is really, as you said, liberating, because it allows to see ourselves not as prisoner of our body. We're no longer inside our bodies. We're no longer our bodies either. But we are the world. We are made of the stuff that it makes our life. So I think that this is really a view that allows us to step outside, I would say, Plato's cave. You know, Western civilization started with Plato's cave. And the idea that we are prisoner of a cave. We saw that in many movies, in Matrix, in Black Mirrors, I recently saw it in another, I don't remember, but anyway, we saw it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
it might be that we're not inside the cave. We are outside. We are the world outside the cave. And what we see, what we are made of, what our dreams are made of, is not a mental ghost. But it is the true world. It is the actual reality. And that, I think, is a very strong notion. Also because it allows to put everyone's experience as a real fact. So as a real expression of nature. As a real expression of reality.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for your work, and I look forward to picking up your book. Yeah, and I apologize. I guess I when I first contacted you, your book was about to be published, so I was still stuck in that mindset that, oh, he's going to be publishing this book, but thankfully it's out already, so that is great to hear. Ricardo, thank you for your time. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a wonderful week, and as a psychedelic bard, Terrence McKenna said, take it easy, dude, but take it.